Legends and Lessons, talking about Nechama Leibowitz. Nechama Leibowitz, obviously not a Rav in the classical sense, but certainly a teacher. Nechama Leibowitz, her yahrzeit is actually tomorrow night, the 5th of Nisan. She was born in 1905, which, you know, puts her in an interesting time, at least in terms of Jewry's movements out of Europe into Eretz Yisrael, ultimately into America. Obviously, they're already going to America, but obviously with World War I, World War II, a lot of shifting going on, and she's part of that too. She was born in Riga, Latvia, to Mordechai and Frieda Leibowitz. She went to public school, and she really learned all her Jewishness from home. Truth is, she had an older brother. I think his name was Yehoshua. But he ended up becoming some kind of Israeli philosopher. And at least according to his Wikipedia page, he was controversial. I don't know. But either way, they were both brought up the same. That's the important part, which is that even though, despite the fact that at that time, obviously women and men were educated very differently, especially as children, because they were homeschooled, so their parents raised them the same way, in terms of Yiddishkeit also. There's somewhat of a rumor I have here as a note. I didn't find it today when I was re-looking at it, but the family was big into literature. And even though that was the case, they actually discouraged her from learning too much Tanakh. That's what I have had down here. I don't know if it's true or not. But the trend was that extensive or in-depth Torah learning was for men. It's just how things went, right? Sarah Schneer wasn't even on the scene yet, right? Sarah Schneer, who started the Beis Yaakov movement, who we talked about a couple of years ago. So that hasn't even started yet. That's a couple decades later. And obviously not in Latvia. So whatever, they were doing it on their own, and at least I've heard different things. One is that they raised them exactly the same. One is that they getting a call here. Sorry if the recording goes out. Yeah. It did go out, so let me just... Okay, everyone's back. Sorry about that. I was getting a call. But the upbringing was generally the same. They taught both of them Torah, which obviously was before the time, was not necessarily an established way of raising girls at that time, early in the 20th century. I believe her mother passed away when she was a child. I couldn't confirm it. A lot of this stuff is unclear. Again, she grew up in Europe, and she was someone who really didn't talk about herself, especially not her personal life, very often, if at all. So we don't know much in terms of the details. There's one story that they say, and I meant to go through a couple of these books, but I didn't have a chance to today. There's a story that apparently, I just thought this was a cute story. I'm not really sure what to learn from it, but one day she woke up late, and because she woke up late, she couldn't daven before she went to public school. And on her way out the door, she slipped on ice and got hit by a passing train. That's what it said. And then she came inside, and she said to her father, that happened. I slipped and got hurt because I didn't daven today. Which is an interesting perspective for apparently a 9-year-old at the time. But then her father says to her, even more interestingly, do you think that you're so holy that Hashem answers your prayers so quickly? It's a very sort of controversial, if you take that to its extreme, it's a controversial statement, theologically interesting to think about, but the father was, trying to teach her that there's some, such thing as haughtiness, even in a spiritual world. And, you never want to blow up any one story into an entire character of a person, but certainly she lives with that kind of balance of a certain trend-setting mentality, not necessarily that she meant to do anything particularly trailblazing, but she did, and she was nonetheless a very modest woman. People were, as she got students, and a student came to her house, which apparently was a common occurrence, so they would be amazed or taken aback at the simplicity of her apartment. But either way, so that's just an interesting anecdote that I saw. I have here also that it could be sort of like an inkling into her spiritual but rational approach to Torah, which is probably a bit of a stretch, but it is an interesting thing that her father was teaching her in the moment, which is, yes, it's important to daven, and yes, it's important to think about Hashem, but also be rational about it. You slipped on ice and you hit a train. It's not because Hashem is sort of like, you know, punishing you in the moment. So it's interesting just to think about that. But when she's 14, her family moves to Berlin, unclear why, but she moves to Berlin, and ultimately she continues learning Torah and Hebrew. There's a story that maybe while she was in Berlin, she saw Rav Soloveitchik at the library, but never talked to him. I don't know, who cares for these stories, but that's apparently the legend. She didn't see the Lubavitch Rebbe, and she never saw Rav Yitzchak Huttner, but she saw the Rav Soloveitchik. That's the story. I saw one version of it that said basically she saw him in a library behind stacks of books. Okay, I don't know. It's famous that Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Huttner, and the Lubavitch Rebbe were all in Berlin at the same time. So there are a lot of these stories. Did they ever meet each other? Did they talk to each other? So you'll find different versions of it. Nechama Leibowitz was also there. You know, the four of them. Either way, so she moves to Berlin, and while she's in Berlin, she goes not only for a regular education, but also to advanced education. She ultimately gets a doctorate by the age of 25. She wrote her thesis on the German translations of Torah. Something to strive for, you know, by the age of, not just 25, but the age of 75. Even know what a German translation of the Torah is. So there are interesting translations, obviously based on the Jewish people in Germany. But she writes a thesis about this, and she particularly, through her studies, developed a great disdain for biblical criticism. I don't know if you're familiar with biblical criticism, but biblical criticism is basically talking about how the Torah is structured in different ways from different authors. And that's why that's how you can explain some contradictions in the Torah. So she was very, very opposed to this, as one should be if they're an Orthodox Jew, or anyone who's looking for truth. But part of her disdain for that came from her willingness and her sort of approach to understand and to recognize, you know, how to explain different inconsistencies in the Torah, which we'll talk about soon. Okay, so what happens? She actually, this is going to get a little peculiar for the moment, but when she is studying for her doctorate or researching for her doctorate, she ends up marrying her uncle, which is not just peculiar because it's her uncle, but it's also peculiar because he was 29 years older than her. This was apparently very controversial in the family. Not sure what happened. We don't know much about the personal life of that of what happened there. But she married her uncle, what was his name? Yedidya. Lipman? I don't know if Lipman is his last name or not, but so she married the uncle. There's a story that apparently the family wasn't at the chuppah. I don't know. There are legends about these things. Again, hard to confirm. But once she gets her doctorate, once she finishes her thesis, that day, I read somewhere, that day they moved to Eretz Yisrael. At that time it was called Mandated Palestine, or whatever they called it, the Mandate of Palestine. So either way, they settled down in Eretz Yisrael. She was very, very Zionistic, in a religious sense, not just in a national sense. But so much so that she almost never left. She left for one trip, apparently, which was a family thing that she had to do. But then she came right back, and she never left Eretz Yisrael. She not only never left Eretz Yisrael, but as Meir had alluded to before, she only ever taught in Hebrew. She was she was a very big proponent of Hebrew language and of making sure that the Jewish people are learning Torah in their language, in their home, in their language. She was a very big proponent of the development of the State of Israel, or not necessarily the State of Israel, but the world of Israel. You know, having a place for the Jewish people and teaching it in the Jewish people's language. Apparently, her husband and uncle, those who are learning Daf Yomi might appreciate that kind of thing, husband and uncle, went blind at some point. And she had to start making money. She always loved teaching, so she figured she'd go into teaching and make some money by doing that. She ended up traveling the entire country. Every few days she would go somewhere else for a different gig. Ultimately, she settles down as a professor at Tel Aviv University, I think it's Tel Aviv University, in Tel Aviv somewhere at least. And but for a while, she was traveling around and I'm not sure if it was because of the 29-year difference or something else, but she could never have children with her husband. I'm sort of jumping all over the place because, again, we don't have a strict personal life timeline here. But she never had children for whatever reason. And people say that they were all her children. They say that when she passed, ultimately in 1997, somebody said that whoever considers themselves the child of her should say Kaddish, because she didn't have any children, so who was going to say Kaddish for her? So apparently thousands of people said Kaddish for her, something like that. I'm not sure the veracity of that either, but that's sort of how people saw her, which is that she couldn't have her own children, but her students, which obviously numbered in the thousands, were considered like her children. She apparently looked at her books, her svarim, as her children. So different takes, both worthwhile perspectives. She very rarely talked about her personal life. She was a very private person. But we ultimately pieced some of these things together. She taught at a teacher's seminary for 25 years, and she had these very sort of smaller group, intimate study sessions with, I think, in her own apartment, with her different students. I'm not sure at what point this happened, but because of some of those classes that she would go around Israel giving, I think she did like a semester's worth with one group, and that group said, we want to continue learning. So she devised this whole new type of system where she would, I don't know if a type out or stencils, right? It was stencils, that's what it was. She had these stencils that she would copy and send out in the mail, and snail mail. Nowadays we would just have classes over Zoom or email or WhatsApp or whatever. She would stencil these questions and sort of outlines of how to learn the parsha. She would send them out to these students. The students would send the answers back, and then she would grade them and send them back, what she thought. So she would literally grade every paper herself. This ultimately, I don't think, was a sustainable model, because she ends up getting thousands of students, because those students and then the friends of those students and family, whatever, it just grows and grows and grows until she was sending these things out, but she wasn't able to, I don't think she was able to grade all of them at the same time. Ultimately, a lot of these become her book, right? Studies in whatever. Yunim B'Sefer or something, whatever. This is the Shmos edition. We'll talk a little bit about one idea from Yetzias Mitzrayim. But she writes a lot of other books. This is probably by far, if I were to guess, her most well-known one, just because it was published and published a few different times, and has become a mainstay of a lot of teachers' bookshelves, at least in modern Orthodox world. Either way. So she had these monthly public classes and corresponded extensively with other audiences. But she has a very specific methodology. And in some ways, some people will say, in all ways, she was very unique in the way she approached learning Torah. It was a very scholarly and academic approach, but it wasn't one that veered away from tradition. So, for instance, she would sometimes quote non-Orthodox authorship, but only when it sort of purported with, it fit together with the Orthodox tradition. So she was a student of other, types of scholarship, like archaeology and geography, but she never included it in her commentaries. I don't know for sure, but my impression is that those more academic studies can cloud the judgment of reading the Tanakh for what the messages of Tanakh are supposed to be, at least in a traditional sense. I saw in one place that the way that she looked at her approach was, in what she thought, similar to how Midrashim would look at Torah, compare and contrast things, and try to understand what's going on between them. In this case, I'm not sure, how I could how I could really glean that for myself, unless I would go through all of them. But in terms of other parts of her methodology, so she would look at psukim. She looks at psukim very poignant analysis. She would not only look at a commentary, but also ask, why did this commentary feel they need to say this? Right, which is a different type of methodology. It's not just so-and-so says this and so-and-so says that. But you know those books like What's Bothering Rashi? I don't know if we have that book. But like that's the type of thing she would do. Like, why does Rashi feel the need? And oftentimes at the end of the parshas, she'll have like further questions for study. So those are oftentimes the types of questions. Why would Rashi comment about this in this way? What was bothering him about the pasuk? Right? So she's always trying to not only understand what is the idea, but what is behind the idea of every commentary. And she would compare and contrast different commentaries, not only their ideas, again, but also how they answered the same question in terms of solving a certain contradiction. She wasn't very often focused with these larger narratives, right? She didn't talk about like the story arc of Yosef's life, but she talked about the scene and how to understand the psukim in Yosef's life. Again, she didn't use history or archaeology to understand anything in the Chumash. And as you can imagine, she was never going to use biblical criticism, at least in the colloquial sense, in terms of pointing out that there are parts of the Torah that contradict each other, and it's because it's, you know, by different authorship. She never did anything like that. It's interesting that we said before that her husband Yedidya, or Lipin, was almost 30 years her senior. So you can imagine that at a certain point she had to start taking care of him. He was elder, you know, older in age. Also, he was blind, so it took a lot to do. Apparently, she was not much of a cook, though. They had a housekeeper. They had a housekeeper that made the food, and she took care of the kitchen, but she didn't really cook much. But either way, she took care of you, did it to the extent that she could. I said before that she didn't have any children. Which I said some people say that her students were her children. She said that her books were her children. Towards the end of her life, she basically said she would give up her entire career, all of the Torah that she ever taught, she would give it up for having one child, which is very sad just to think about. You know how much she must have wanted one. But I think there's a story about her teaching her class, I'm not sure if it's in the book or it's just a legendary story, about teaching her class about Hagar. And Hagar, who had essentially abandoned Yishmael on the side of the road, and how she couldn't relate to that, or one of the students couldn't relate to that, or something like that. There was like a whole conversation around that. And I forgot the sort of the moral of the story, but it was very indicative of her view of caring for children and how much she wanted her own. But I don't remember it, so I can't tell you the whole thing. She studied with many people, not just Orthodox Jews, but even non-Orthodox Jews, she studied with them. What does it say here? I have here that she studied with Rev Heshi Billet, who's in Five Towns, and studied with Rav Soloveitchik's son, Chumash Rashi. I don't know. Again, hard to understand some of these things. She was known for her worksheets, which were called Gilyonot. Unclear why they would call them Gilyonot, but I guess things that you had to fill out more. And what she was trying to do, and this is why she would give them questions, not just the ideas, because she was trying to promote their thinking about things, their deep analysis on their own. Why did Rashi say this? I'm not going to tell you. Figure it out yourself. And that's why they would write answers back. So this is similar to sort of the methodology of my questions on Shabbos. Like, I don't want to just give over Dvar Torah. I want people to try to understand the question, to try to sort of think about it on their own, and sort of get invested in the Torah on your own, as opposed to being a passive learner, being an active learner. Right, she didn't see herself as innovative, but many look at her as being a very innovative teacher in the way that she taught. She published the worksheets with answers, even though she didn't want to, which ultimately became, you know, part of these books. She ultimately, as I said before, grew on the grew to be part of the Tel Aviv University. I think ultimately she wins all these awards for different types of education in Jewish thought. And in the end of the day, the only thing I think it says on her tombstone, on her Maseva, is Nechama Leibowitz Mora. That's all she wanted to be known as. She was a teacher. And certainly a teacher which was, to me, a representative of, I would say, three important elements. This is my own thing. I didn't read this anywhere, but this is my impression of her. Number one, she, and this could be just by nature of Israel at the time. You know, you find this also similar with Shlomo Carlebach, that she didn't care for big public classes. She didn't care for being at the front of the room and lecturing. She wanted to have more of a conversational class, again, so that people, she could elicit conversation. But because of that, it was more of an intimate relationship, that her Torah wasn't sort of lecture style. It wasn't sort of passive. It was intimate. She would have small groups in her small apartment, and they got to know each other. And it was much more interactive type of Torah study. And I think that's a lesson that's very important, because especially in the generation of Google, which she didn't have, but especially in the generation of Google, where everything is very, very monologuing, you know, just the teacher telling us. There's a word for that. No, there's a teacher for, there's a word for that type of teaching. Can't think of it now. Autodidactic, is that what that means? I don't remember. Where it's just the teacher speaking and everybody else listening. So, especially in the day that we live, we don't need teachers for that anymore. I mean, we do, obviously, you know, experts that know the class, that know the people we're talking to. But you can get that from other places. You can get that from YU Torah or Torah Anytime or Kol HaLashon. You can listen to plenty of lectures where you have no interaction with the teacher. Nowadays, I think it's particularly important to maintain the teacher-student relationship, because that relationship goes further than just sort of information. And that's really where people grow as Jews, not just as students. So that's one thing that I take from her as one of those very innovative elements, and it's existed for all time. It's not like she made it, but she was always very, you know, adamant about having these smaller class sizes and having these relationships with personal students. That's number one. Number two was, she was a very great example of the Mishnah in Avos, which says, Ezu Chacham Halomed Mikol Adam. If there's one thing you'll find in her books, is that she quotes sources that nobody's ever heard of, but that weren't non-traditional sources. They just didn't make it into the mainstream. So we'll pick up a Chumash, and we'll see the classics, obviously Rashi, and the Ramban, and the Rashbam, and the Kli Yakar, and the Orach Chaim, the ones that make it into the books, you know? She quotes people that I've never heard of, and people that that didn't necessarily get left out because their commentary wasn't good. It's just wrong place, wrong time, wrong publisher. It just didn't make it to the forefront of a rabbi's desk. So, and there are some that certainly sort of have become more popular in, you know, in modern day when we found these, we can digitize them and sort of republish them. You know, the Ralbag comes to mind, a very sort of unique biblical commentary, Orthodox Jew, not, you know, but maybe his views were a little off of center. They weren't exactly mainstream at the time or even today. Things like predestination and stuff like that, if I remember correctly. But the point is, I'm not sure, it might have been the other direction, that nothing, less hashkacha, I don't remember. But the point is that there were authors like that through history that she valued them. I don't know how she found them, but she found those commentaries. She would even photocopy them and send them. I don't know what you would call it back then. It's not photocopy. What would it be called? You had a photocopy? You had Xerox back then? In the 40s, 50s?
No, that was
stencils. Stencils is what she would manually do, the stencils. But in terms of, like, if she had like a text that she wanted to give, maybe she'd do it stencils manually also. I don't know. Right, she would
type it.
A bibliograph? I don't know. Oh, that's the same thing? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, smells never leave you. Yeah. But either way, so she would quote these sources, and she quotes mainstream sources as well. I'm not saying she doesn't, but she wasn't unwilling to quote people sources that people had never heard of. Sometimes non-Orthodox, as I said before, also, as long as there's a kernel of truth inside of their traditional understanding that she thought was relevant, it was in how to understand the text of the Torah. So then she was willing to include it. So that I think is a very a noble approach, that we shouldn't necessarily dismiss commentaries because we're not familiar with them. Look into them, make sure that they're Orthodox. Obviously, you don't want to be reading a heretical book, but also to recognize that there's value in every person's commentary if they're doing it the L'shem Shemayim. So that was her methodology. That's why you'll find in her books many of these names you're not even familiar with. I've talked about them with David Barth before. We've talked about, because he's familiar with that kind of thing. But the third thing, so that was number one. Number one was the intimate classes, that those relationships. Number two was lomim mikaladim, and number three was nuance. Many people look at Nechama Leibowitz as a feminist trendsetter, and she never wanted to be that. She was, by nature of what she was doing, by dint of her career and what she chose to do, she was a trendsetter. She taught Torah to women, predominantly women, men also, but in an innovative and more scholarly academic way within traditional understanding of the Torah. So she didn't think she was being innovative, but she was. At the same time, when people would come to her and ask her about, sort of feminist activities of the day, should we put tefillin on? Should we strive for more public rabbinic positions? Should we sort of switch the dynamic of gender roles? She was against all of that. For Talmud Torah, she thought that was a gift from Hashem that we all have to, we can't not partake in. But when it came to changing gender roles or societal roles, she was not a fan of pushing the envelope, of changing, the minhagim, of taking upon yourself more obligations than you're obligated. She was basically, her response was always like, Hashem told us to do something, that's what we should do. We shouldn't try to change the Torah. Right? We take the tradition as it is. And for this, I thought that maybe she was sort of like a great representation of being able to hold that nuance. Not many people can hold that nuance. People, and this is why, by the way, that historically, people look back at Nechama Leibowitz in one of two ways. Those who understand this aspect of her personality understand that she was just like any other Torah teacher, as a chain in the tradition, a chain in the Mesorah. And then others, obviously because she was one of a kind in terms of being a female Torah teacher, looked at her as a feminist trendsetter. And they'll look at her as sort of like the feminist that we should all look up to. She never wanted to be like that, at least from my research. She always wanted things of Yiddishkeit to be as Yiddishkeit is. She was not trying to change, culture. She was trying to maintain culture, but just to do so in a more depth or analytical way, especially at least from an educational standpoint. So those are the three elements that I took away from her career that drew a standout that we can take for ourselves also, that those intimate relationships are important in terms of learning also. And then number two is to learn from anybody, to make sure that you can glean that which is most valuable from any type of commentary, no matter who it is, halomein bikol adam. And then lastly, to be able to hold that nuance, to be able to hold that dissonance where just because I'm a woman and I am sort of setting a trend, that doesn't mean that we're taking everything else, that goes along with feminism too, to be able to sort of hold that, to hold that line, I think was also a sort of a standout quality of hers. So that's Nechama Leibowitz in a nutshell. She ends up passing away in 1997. At the age of 92 years old, you might see her pictures of her. She always looks, a little frail, at least the older years. Again, she looked very modestly, she looked as though she was 92. She passes away on Hei Nisan, the 5th of Nisan, which begins tomorrow night. But I wanted to finish with a piece from her actual book. This is her fourth piece on Parshas Bo. And the question that she's dealing with, or the topic that she's dealing with, is one of the psukim about the four sons. I believe the one at the end of Parshas Bo is the one from the Tam. But here, I'm not sure 100% who she's quoting here, which she's quoting here. V'hayaki yomru alechem b'nechem, maha avarah azos lachem. This is the Rasha. This is earlier in Parshas Bo. The later one in Parshas Bo, there are a couple more in Parshas Bo. There's a v'yigad livin chmayom ha'leimor b'avor zeh, asa Hashem lim seiz mitram. I believe that's the Sheni Yodei Lishol. And then here's v'hayaki yishalcha b'nechem achar leimor, when your child asks you tomorrow, saying, what is this? So that's the Tam. The Chacham statement is later on in Parshas Vayeschanan. But three of them are in Parshas Bo. And she analyzes each one of them. And I'm just going to sort of like a little snippet here to understand how she talks and how she sort of analyzes things. The foregoing exegesis cites the verses not in their biblical order, but grades them according to the actual intellectual capacities of the children, right? First the wise son, then the wicked who is equally intelligent but malicious, followed by the simple son who has enough intelligence to ask, and finally the one who hasn't enough intellectual curiosity to say anything. That's an interesting one. She quotes that from the Avudraham commentary on the Medrash itself, I think. But what's interesting, the way she presents it is, it's not necessarily somebody, the Ener Yodei Lishol is not necessarily someone who's a baby, right? Oftentimes you'll find these illustrated Haggadahs, they'll show the kid as a baby that doesn't know how to talk at all. That's not the Ener Yodei Lishol. The Ener Yodei Lishol isn't just like a silly kid. The Ener Yodei Lishol is someone who just doesn't know enough even to ask. Imagine going to a place where, your first day of, organic chemistry, and the teacher starts the class off by saying, does anyone have any questions? So what do you mean, do I have any questions? I don't know the first thing about organic chemistry. Why would I have any questions? So that's the Ener Yodei Lishol. They're not stupid. They just don't know enough to even ask a question. So that's how she's interpreting it. Also, the one who hasn't enough intellectual curiosity to say anything, they're not into it yet. A different interpretation is advanced by the Bi'ur HaMidos. I don't know who that is. A commentary to the Medrash also. He places the simple and wicked sons at the two extremes of the Jewish spectrum and sphere of performance. The simple man is ready, in the simplicity and purity of his faith, to accept even the irrational. Even that which is irrational, the simple son is willing to do it. The wicked man even repudiates the rational and is the enemy of society and good order. The wise and foolish sons represent the two extremes in the sphere of competence. So this commentary splits up in different ways. The simple and the wicked are on two sides of the same spectrum in terms of their willingness to do the mitzvot. And the wise and the foolish son, meaning the one that doesn't know how to ask, so those represent to the extent of competence. The Chacham knows a lot of things. He can teach you about things. Whereas the Ani Odea doesn't know. That's by definition. The wise son wants to discover the meaning underlying everything to the full extent of intellectual capacities. The foolish one does not possess the curiosity to investigate anything. Most commentaries, however, regard the simple son as at the lower end of the scale intellectually and not in any way as representing a superior level of religious faith. Meaning that the simple son is simple. Not that he's the most fulfilling of all the sons, but that he's just that he's lower level intellectually. It is difficult to understand the choice of text for the wicked son's question. What does this service mean to you? What is wrong with the wording to you? The same phrase is used by many worthy men in scriptures, and then she goes on to quote verses from Yehoshua. In none of these cases has the phrase roused the ire of the expositor. So why all of a sudden are we picking on the Rasha? The Rasha says the word to you. A lot of the prophets use the word to you, and they never posed a problem. Many answers have been suggested. The wise son makes mention of the name of God, which the Lord our God has commanded you, meaning he says the word Elokeinu. The Rasha never said that word. Elokeinu would include him within the context of Torah Mitzvot. Since he recognizes the Godhead, his words cannot be construed as heresy. Moreover, in asking the reason for various types of ritual, he did not miss out the important thing, which the Lord our God hath commanded you. So he recognizes the necessity of commandments. The wise son appreciates the positive nature of all these commandments, whereas the wicked one sees the service, but not the author of the service, meaning, what's this work stuff that you guys are doing? He doesn't mention Hashem at all. He doesn't see that it translates to or reflects back to Hashem. The root of sin lay in man's failure to accept the divine word as binding on him as an imperative to be fulfilled. That's the problem. The problem is not that you don't know about mitzvot, it's that you don't understand how the mitzvot fit into the context of your relationship with Hashem. Furthermore, the wise son accepts the threefold division of divine laws into testimonies, right? Chukim and Mishpatim. Those commandments testifying to the existence of and providence of Hashem, such as Tefillin, Mezuzah, and Pesach, statutes whose reasons are not apparent, and laws, rational laws, whose motives are appreciated by all. In place of all this, the wicked man sees service. Admittedly, the Torah itself calls the passive ritual the word service, meaning he said he uses the word avoda. But there are different types of using the word avoda. Avoda could be labor, or avoda could mean service. Even in English, we can translate it in one of two ways. So the wicked son sees avoda. I talked about this in this way on Shabbos. That avoda is a burden. Right? That's how the Rasha looks at the Torah and mitzvot. It's a burden. I don't want to do this. Whereas the Chacham uses the word avoda also, but he uses it as service. I want to do something for Hashem. But since the term is ambiguous and can be used for both service and servitude or bondage, we apprehend that the wicked son is using it in the latter, derogatory sense. The Talmud Yerushalmi indeed interprets the wicked sons in this test. Maha avoda hazos lachem, maha toreach hazeh, sha'atem matrichem aleinu b'chol shana v'shana. What is all this burden? That's how the Yerushalmi says that. I didn't know that. Similarly, we find the word used in the sense of bondage in the immediate context, and they afflicted us and imposed on us hard labor, avodah kasha. But the most plausible explanation of the difference between the wise and wicked sons' respective texts lies in an apparently insignificant variation occurring. Not in their actual words, but in the introduction to their question. The wise son will ask of thee, but the wicked son shall say to you. What's the difference between those? One is ask, one is say. Right? The wicked son is introduced, ki yomru aleichem, when they will say. Very interesting. I've talked about this before. So long as the son asks, so provocative his questions are. It is a sign that he expects an answer, a solution to his difficulties. He wants to know. He is far from being malicious, but is merely a student thirsty for knowledge. The wicked one, on the other hand, does not ask and desires no reply. Then when your children say to you, he's saying, he's not asking. Their attitude is already fixed and predetermined. They do not want to hear a reply. They are therefore called wicked. The same idea is expressed in Akedas Yitzchak. The text here does not refer to the constructive questionings, but rather to destructive ones, and they are legion. I'm not sure what that means. There are other commentaries that I've seen the same idea, that the Rasha is saying his claim. He's not asking a question. There aren't many people ask questions they don't want answers to. They're just asking questions in order to poke holes. We talked about that in Mishlei also. So that's the idea from the Chamuli Woods, but then she gives us two questions. More food for thought, right? Those are some examples of why the Rasha and the Chacham are different, even though they have similar verbiage in terms of Lachem or Esten. So those, I think she gave three different answers, by the way. Akedas Yitzchak, not so popular, has become more popular. The Yerushalmi, not something everyone reads every day. And the Biurei Hamidos, I've never even heard of it. So you can see already, she's familiar with the Abu Jurham, which is a classic commentary, the Mechilta, the Medrash classic, and Akedas Yitzchak, which was somewhat known, but then these other sources that she quotes from, even though it's not very mainstream to quote them. But last questions for further study. The Torah itself gives its own answer to the wicked son's question. What does this service mean to you? By stating, you shall say it is the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover. Right, that's what the pasuk says. That's what you should say back to this question. But why did the sages substitute another answer for this one, putting the answer of the one who has not the intelligence to ask into the wicked son's mouth? Right? The answer to the wicked son's question is what we say to the Eni Yode Elishol. So that's our food for thought. Why did we switch the answers? Okay. What prompted the sages to give the text in Exodus 13:8? Because of this the Lord did for me to the one who has no intelligence to ask. Bavor Zeh Hashem Li. This is why Hashem did it. Where is there an allusion in the text to its appropriateness for this son? Why would we give that reasoning to the Enyo de Elisho. So those are some questions that she proposes just to us, sort of food for thought at the Seder, if you will. And she's not going to answer them. She's going to let you try to figure it out on your own, which was her methodology of teaching also, to make sure that, again, it's an intimate conversation where there's interaction between the teacher and the student, not just a monologue from the teacher. So that's Nechama Leibowitz's life and lessons in a nutshell. Obviously, a lot more to talk about, a lot more to learn about from her books. We have them here, those blue books on the shelf over there. If anyone wants to borrow them, they're more than welcome. Certainly a worthwhile read. It really gets you to think. Hopefully you sort of pause after her questions and try to think about it yourself. And in that way, do what she wants, what she always strove to do, which is to think about the Torah deeply and with a more analytical eye towards explicating the Torah and not just taking the commentary's ideas for what they say. Okay, that's Nechama Leibowitz in a nutshell. Thank you, I believe, to the Rubies for sponsoring tonight's class. I don't have a bulletin with me, but I believe it's Saul's parents, one of Saul's parents. So is Saul's parents? Let me just check this. We will still have class next week, I think. Let me just check.
For birthday.
Oh, it was for a birthday. It was for Jen's birthday. Okay, so happy birthday to Jen. Thank you to the Rubies for sponsoring in honor of her birthday. She should live on Meir Ves Mishana. She should be well and healthy. Everyone else should be well also. Thank you for coming. And we'll have Mishle class next week.